welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. Today on the program, we hear from Susan Shand, Mario Ritter, and Alice Bryant. We end our program with an American story. Today, we'll hear Luck by Mark Twain. But first,
China is launching an extensive and well-funded effort to influence American politics and society, a new report says. The report, Chinese Influence and American Interests, was written by leading experts on China for Stanford University's Hoover Institution and the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Its release comes as the U.S. and China dispute their trade relationship and compete for influence around the world. Larry Diamond and Orville Schell led the creation of the report. They noted that China's latest effort began when Xi Jinping came to power in 2012 as the Communist Party's General Secretary. They said China sought to establish its influence and to present a China option as a more efficient economic development model than liberal democracy. The report said China is using America's openness to increase its influence while limiting America's efforts to connect with Chinese society. Winston Lord, a former ambassador to China, helped write the report. He said, "This report, I think, is a microcosm of the current status of U.S.-Chinese relations generally. It's a fairly ominous landscape, and I think it mirrors an ominous crossroads in U.S.-Chinese relations."
The report said China seeks to influence rising U.S. politicians and gain influence with members of Congress. Chinese companies admit that they spent $3.8 million to support issues with lawmakers in 2017. In some rare examples, China used private citizens and companies to make contributions to U.S. elections. For example, Wang Wenliang, a Chinese businessman, contributed $120,000 to Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe's campaign. In the Chinese-American community, China has sought to silence critics of its policies and supporters of Taiwan by pressuring their relatives in mainland China. In education, China opened 110 Confucius Institutes at colleges and 501 Confucius classrooms in high schools around the U.S. The institutes aim to provide students and communities with Chinese language and culture. However, they are required to use Communist Party-approved materials and to avoid any discussion of Tibet, Tiananmen Square, Xinjiang, the Falun Gong, or human rights.
Several universities, including the University of Chicago, Penn State University, and Texas A&M, have closed the institutes at their schools because of the restrictions. During the 2017-2018 academic year, a record 350,755 Chinese students attended American universities, and another 80,000 attended high schools. But some members of the Chinese Students and Scholars Association have been accused of spying on other Chinese students and American teachers. A public example took place last year at the University of Maryland. Chinese student Yang Shuping spoke at the school's graduation and praised the fresh air of free speech in the U.S. compared to China. Her comments were widely shared in China. She then received email threats, and her family in China was harassed. The report noted that the U.S. is open to Chinese scholars. It said that China, however, restricts access to American scholars and researchers seeking to study politically sensitive areas of China's political system, society, and history in country. In 2007, China launched its Grand Overseas Propaganda Campaign. The official Xinhua news agency expanded around the world from 120 offices to more than 200 offices. The state-owned China Global Television Network currently broadcasts in 7 languages. Its American operations include 1 broadcast in English, 12 in Mandarin Chinese, 2 in Cantonese, and 1 in Hokkien.
At the same time, the Chinese government has blocked American and Western media organizations in the country. Many foreign reporters have said that they have experienced harassment and physical violence during their work in China. Some have had difficulties renewing their visas. Others have learned that their Chinese contacts have been detained by officials for speaking with them. In business, the report said China uses its companies to support its interests and gain important technologies. The U.S. House of Representatives declared Chinese companies, Huawei and ZTE, a national security threat in 2012. The two companies have been accused of bribery and spying in Africa. American companies with investments in China are often forced to transfer technology to local businesses. China has also been accused of stealing new technology through its investments in U.S. companies and through the openness of American university research.
American culture, including music and movies, has long been the country's most popular export to China and the world. In recent years, China has become an important market for ticket sales and of financing for Hollywood movies. This has led to several examples of self-censorship to positively present China. In the 2012 movie Red Dawn, MGM Studio digitally altered the invading Chinese army into one from North Korea. The change came after criticism from the Chinese state-owned Global Times. The Martian is a popular 2015 movie made with Chinese investment. The main character, played by Matt Damon, was the only survivor after an explosion on Mars. And he was finally saved by the China National Space Administration. The report added that China's effort goes beyond the U.S. It says the activities are taking place around the world. Australia, Africa, and Latin America are some of the places. The effort appears to be even more developed in Asia and Europe. More than 30 China experts helped write the report, which also received support from the Annenberg Foundation Trust.
I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Years ago, music theory professor Patricia Hall traveled to Poland's Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum. She hoped to learn about the music performed by prisoners in World War II death camps. Hall, who teaches music at the University of Michigan, had heard that the museum had handwritten manuscripts of such songs. But she was surprised by what she found at the museum, unexpectedly happy and popular works with names such as The Most Beautiful Time of Life and Sing a Song When You're Sad. Hall returned to the Polish Museum several times over the next 2 years. She continued to study other handwritten manuscripts of songs arranged and performed by prisoners. And this week, a musical group performed one of these songs for the first time since Auschwitz prisoners played it during the war. Hall told the Associated Press, "I've used the expression giving life to this manuscript that's been sitting somewhere for 75 years. Researching one of these manuscripts is just the beginning. You want people to be able to hear what these pieces sound like." From 1940 to 1945, more than 1 million people, most of whom were Jewish, died in Auschwitz-Birkenau's gas chambers or from hunger, disease, and forced labor. Hall said she felt it was important for modern audiences to hear the prisoners' music. So she asked Josh DeVries, a University of Michigan student, and university professor Oriol Sons to rewrite the manuscripts onto special music software. This made it easier to read and play the music. Sons is also director of the school's Contemporary Directions Ensemble. Last month, the group of musicians gathered to play and record The Most Beautiful Time of Life. The recording is to become part of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum. That is the same song the group played this week during a free performance at the University of Michigan. The performance was live streamed for audiences around the world. Hall estimates that the song was last performed in 1942 or 1943 by Auschwitz prisoners. The prisoners would sometimes put on concerts for German soldiers. The prisoners themselves did not write the piece. They may have heard the song in the years before they were put in the concentration camp, as it was a popular song in the 1940s. The prisoners did, however, arrange the music to work for the few instruments available. Hall has so far identified two of the three prisoners who arranged the piece. They are Antoni Gargul, who was released from Auschwitz in 1943, and Maximilian Pilat, who was released in 1945. Both were Polish political prisoners. Survivors and museum officials have said musicians received more food than most other prisoners, had clean clothes, and did not perform the hardest labor. But museum director Piotr M. A. Swinski said that they also experienced some of the worst terrors of the camp. And Hall said of the musicians, "We like to think that the musicians were saved because they had that ability to play instruments. However, it's been documented by another prisoner that about 50 of them were taken out and shot." Hall said she was surprised that no one discovered the manuscripts earlier. She said she found about 8 other manuscripts that she hopes will get recorded and performed in the future. She says she will let someone else do that, however. She describes the environment in Auschwitz-Birkenau as quite depressing. "I go back and forth about how much further I'm going to research these manuscripts," Hall said. I'm Susan Shand.
Now it's time for an American story. Today we hear Luck by Mark Twain. Here is Shep O'Neill, your narrator.
I was at a dinner in London, given in honor of one of the most celebrated English military men of his time. I do not want to tell you his real name and titles. I will just call him Lieutenant General Lord Arthur Scoresby. I cannot describe my excitement when I saw this great and famous man. There he sat, the man himself, in person, all covered with medals. I could not take my eyes off him. He seemed to show the true mark of greatness. His fame had no effect on him. The hundreds of eyes watching him, the worship of so many people, did not seem to make any difference to him. Next to me sat a clergyman, who was an old friend of mine. He was not always a clergyman. During the first half of his life, he was a teacher in the military school at Woolwich. There was a strange look in his eye as he leaned toward me and whispered, "Privately, he is a complete fool." He meant, of course, the hero of our dinner. This came as a shock to me. I looked hard at my friend. I could not have been more surprised if he had said the same thing about Napoleon, or Socrates, or Solomon. But I was sure of two things about the clergyman. He always spoke the truth, and his judgment of men was good. Therefore, I wanted to find out more about our hero as soon as I could. Some days later, I got a chance to talk with the clergyman, and he told me more. These are his exact words. "About 40 years ago,
I was an instructor in the military academy at Woolwich when young Scoresby was given his first examination. I felt extremely sorry for him. Everybody answered the questions, well, intelligently, while he, why, dear me, he did not know anything, so to speak. He was a nice, pleasant young man. It was painful to see him stand there and give answers that were miracles of stupidity. I knew, of course, that when examined again, he would fail and be thrown out. So, I said to myself, it would be a simple, harmless act to help him as much as I could. I took him aside and found he knew a little about Julius Caesar's history, but he did not know anything else. So I went to work and tested him and worked him like a slave. I made him work over and over again on a few questions about Caesar, which I knew he would be asked. If you will believe me, he came through very well on the day of the examination. He got high praise, too, while others, who knew 1,000 times more than he, were sharply criticized. By some strange, lucky accident, he was asked no questions but those I made him study. Such an accident does not happen more than once in 100 years. Well, all through his studies, I stood by him with the feeling a mother has for a disabled child. And he always saved himself by some miracle. I thought that what in the end would destroy him would be the mathematics examination. I decided to make his end as painless as possible. So I pushed facts into his stupid head for hours. Finally, I let him go to the examination to experience what I was sure would be his dismissal from school. Well, sir, try to imagine the result. I was shocked out of my mind. He took first prize, and he got the highest praise. I felt guilty day and night. What I was doing was not right, but I only wanted to make his dismissal a little less painful for him. I never dreamed it would lead to such strange, laughable results. I thought that sooner or later, one thing was sure to happen. The first real test, once he was through school, would ruin him. Then the Crimean War broke out. I felt that sad for him that there had to be a war. Peace would have given this donkey a chance to escape from ever being found out as being so stupid. Nervously, I waited for the worst to happen. It did. He was appointed an officer, a captain of all things. Who could have dreamed that they would place such a responsibility on such weak shoulders as his? I said to myself that I was responsible to the country for this. I must go with him and protect the nation against him as far as I could. So I joined up with him, and away we went to the field. And there, oh dear, it was terrible. Mistakes, fearful mistakes. Why, he never did anything that was right. Nothing but mistakes. But you see, nobody knew the secret of how stupid he really was. Everybody misunderstood his actions. They saw his stupid mistakes as works of great intelligence. They did, honestly. His smallest mistakes made a man in his right mind cry and shout and scream, too, to himself, of course. And what kept me in a continual fear was the fact that every mistake he made increased his glory and fame. I kept saying to myself that when at last they find out about him, it will be like the sun falling out of the sky. He continued to climb up over the dead bodies of his superiors. Then, in the hottest moment of one battle, down went our colonel. My heart jumped into my mouth, for Scoresby was the next in line to take his place. "Now we are in for it," I said. The battle grew hotter. The English and their allies were steadily retreating all over the field. Our regiment occupied a position that was extremely important. One mistake now would bring total disaster. And what did Scoresby do this time? He just mistook his left hand for his right hand. That was all. An order came for him to fall back and support our right. Instead, he moved forward and went over the hill to the left. We were over the hill before this insane movement could be discovered and stopped. And what did we find? A large and unsuspected Russian army waiting. And what happened? Were we all killed? That is exactly what would have happened in 99 cases out of 100. But no, those surprised Russians thought that no one regiment by itself would come around there at such a time. It must be the whole British army, they thought. They turned tail. Away they went over the hill and down into the field in wild disorder, and we after them. In no time there was the greatest turnaround you ever saw. The Allies turned defeat into a sweeping and shining victory. The Allied commander looked on, his head spinning with wonder, surprise, and joy. He sent right off for Scoresby and put his arms around him and hugged him on the field in front of all the armies. Scoresby became famous that day as a great military leader, honored throughout the world. That honor will never disappear while history books last. He is just as nice and pleasant as ever, but he still does not know enough to come in out of the rain. He is the stupidest man in the universe. Until now, nobody knew it but Scoresby and myself. He has been followed day by day, year by year, by a strange luck. He has been a shining soldier in all our wars for years. He has filled his whole military life with mistakes. Every one of them brought him another honorary title. Look at his chest, flooded with British and foreign medals. Well, sir, every one of them is the record of some great stupidity or other. They are proof that the best thing that can happen to a man is to be born lucky. I say again, as I did at the dinner, Scoresby's a complete fool.
And that's our show for today. From VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.